Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hello and welcome to Compound Interests with me, John Najarian. Folks, every week I get to sit down with somebody who's a luminary in finance, who's a star of stage or screen. And this week, that star was David Hightower. He writes the Hightower Report, and it's daily commodity research. If you're somebody who's even come this close into any of these areas, grains, livestock, metals, financial, energy, and so forth, soybeans, chances are you're familiar at least with the name. And David and I had a wide-ranging discussion about all of those topics. And I think in particular, you'll want to stay tuned for the parts where he talks about silver and gold, because those are things that we trade a lot. And that has really put a boost on the portfolio, the same way Apple and Tesla have in our equity portfolios. But like I say, David Hightower of HightowerReport.com joins me. Please give it a listen and tell your friends about it. And by the way, give us a 5-star rating when you listen to Compound Interests.
Good to be here.
Now, David, when you're out there, I've read a lot of what you've been writing about. Most recently, I guess, I was reading about soybeans and so forth, probably because a lot of us are talking about that with, whenever we're not talking about the election, we're talking about something with the president and China. And obviously, China's been a very significant buyer of pork bellies, of soybeans. They have taken on an obligation, I guess, under the terms of the most recent negotiations with the president and his team, David Navarro and those guys, to basically buy a lot of U.S. goods to not necessarily equalize the trade gap, but at least to give the president something that he wants very desperately for the farmers, and that is a great export spot like China that has an almost insatiable demand for protein. What do you think of where soybeans are now, David, and what would be a prediction from you as far as support and resistance levels going forward?
Well, I also have, in the last several years, I've done a lot of travel for the U.S. Soybean Export Council. And we made a lot of trips to China, been over there a lot. And we changed our focus a little bit and tried to focus on South America, to get other clients, with the trade war heating up. And, an agreement and a phase one agreement to buy so much in the way of commodities. I've been going to China for 28 years, and they're not going to buy anything that's not the cheapest they can purchase it at. They're going to go where it's cheap. And when it suits their pocketbook, they're going to buy it from the U.S. So recently we've seen the dollar slide aggressively. And so that's increasing the attractiveness of our commodities, and China's been in aggressively. I mean, it would almost seem like they're trying to placate U.S. negotiators on the trade issue, because it's been a lot of beans and a lot of corn. But when you look at the soybean market, I mean, we've had crop conditions this year running well above normal, so we had a really good crop. But it's important to note that August is the most important month for the development and the yield on the soybeans. And so when you look across, we had only 25% of normal rain in Iowa and Indiana in the month of August. You look through, I think Tom Skilling had earlier this week, June, July, and August had the hottest average temperature ever in the Midwest. So there certainly is, when you have a little bit of moisture shortage and a lot of heat right in a critical production stage, that's when it does have an impact on yield. So we've knocked down prices, we deflated them off of the crisis. I try to tell people, look at the panic area. The panic area on the charts was, we're going to lock down the U.S. in early March. And look at where prices were at that time and realize, look, we deflated prices from that point. because of macros, not necessarily because of internal fundamentals. So I see November beans as probably have made a low, and a break back down to 928, I think, puts you down at that level that's going to cause more export money to come in for our supply. And, you know, you could see a valuation increase due to, I believe the virus situation will be at an end, meaning the uncertainty. We're not going to have the vaccine out there, but the uncertainty and the panic and the fear from that, I think, will be done before the end of October. Three late stage vaccines. And again, it's a perception of anxiety. So if you reflate sentiment at the same time that you notch down the size of the crop, you know, you could see 1090, maybe even $11 beans.
Well, from that March low in beans, beans were beneath 830, I think, in March, maybe around 820 or so. And now here they are in the 950s. So like you say, this has been a pretty much from the lower left to the upper right graph that has just gone like this, David.
Right.
And obviously China's a big part of that. Is there anything going on down in Brazil, which is of course a huge producer of beans? Is there anything going on down there that would cause them not to fill some of this demand, or are they just selling right along with us, you know, sale for sale over to China, sort of like when we had not an embargo, but when we had them buying beans from us only to ship them over to China?
Well, I mean, there are some quality differences that can make a difference. And when you have prices this low, some food makers will decide, hey, why not get the higher quality stuff when the cost is relatively small differential? But they've also sold a lot of theirs forward. But an even bigger impact is the fact that Indonesia and Malaysia have moved forward to enforce a mandate to utilize 5% and 10% of their domestic palm production in biodiesel. And when you look at the world oil, edible oil market, you see that, first of all, palm is seven times the productive capacity as bean oil, cottonseed oil, linseed oil, all the other edible oils combined. So if you take a small amount of cut out of the palm oil supply available to the world, and Indonesia and Malaysia basically export all of what they produce, so you create a little bit of a shortage in palm oil that eats up a lot of soybean oil, and the bean oil market's been leading and pulling up the soybean market. So it's not just a function of what the ending stocks will be in soybeans, but the product prices are starting to go up also.
Now, David, I know that you're an analyst and a technician and so forth, but could I ask you what you think the impact is going to be on U.S. consumption? Because obviously we're back to some of the recent highs, or very close to it, for soybeans. Is this going to have an impact on some of the stuffs that we buy? Everything from some of the animals that we feed soybeans to some of us that are consuming beans in one way or another.
Well, the poultry production and the profitability in the livestock area has also come up. Mm-hmm. And you, some of that was the result of just some short-term hoarding that took place. So some of the producers are benefiting from that so that they can absorb a higher input cost to that equation. So I'm not sure with many commodities, only 5-10% of the total product cost, I don't know if that's going to inflate because we do have other supplies available beans. So I don't know if it's going to transmission into higher food prices.
Now, one of the things I'd love to get across to the listeners and viewers, David, is what your background is, how you got started in doing this, because, you know, to have a 30 plus year career, which you've had, and to have the Hightower Report be so much at the forefront of a lot of these letters that are out there, whether they're daily and weekly or monthly subscriptions and things like that. You guys have one of the best names in the business. How did you get started? Were you working for a man or a woman that really sort of took you along as you were making your entry into this business, or how did you get started in futures and in particular in these commodities?
Well, I was extremely fortunate, and I was maybe the last of the old style CBOT traders from the pit. I started in the bond pit. I was only down there a month. I started doing research programming for the largest research department in the futures business at that time. Within 2 years, I became the assistant director of research. Then I became the director of research, and I had about 40 analysts underneath me. So I had a huge budget and was in the process of automating the data. But more importantly, being in the Board of Trade and being in with the some of these the market gurus and the big name guys. I mean, we had bond traders trading 3,000 lots of bonds, and I was invited to the morning meeting, and they called it the war room. And you know, there'd be 20 or 30 guys that at that time had been there at the in the building for 50 years. And so I listened a lot in the beginning. And when you offered your opinion, they would attack you. And if you didn't have the fundamental knowledge and backing of that opinion, you don't do the research after you do the trade. You do the research before the trade. And so I was fortunate. I had a lot of interaction with these guys, and a lot of them still call me. And so you get the old and the new perspective. I also, I've been in 56 countries in the last 5 years. I've been in almost and involved in almost every commodity market, whether it's hedging for the Indian wheat purchases for against the monsoon, coffee hedging in South America. So a lot of things. And you know, when you have the largest daily circulation of daily commentary in the world, you're tested every day. I mean, if you put something in there that doesn't make rational sense or is incorrect, you're going to hear about it. So I also have 8 guys working for me that we've all been together in excess of 30 years. So, yeah, so, I mean, we've got a niche, and I was fortunate to have a lot of people give me their knowledge. And then I've changed it into the real modern type of faster information environment.
All right. Well, one of the things that I know that you've said time and time again in interviews that I've heard or read about is that China is not an indiscriminate buyer, that for the most part, China will buy when the price is right. I think, you know, like the television program, you've said that many times, that China buys when they think there's a good price point, rather than just chasing it at whatever the highs might be. They might actually step back and not be as nearly aggressive, even though, of course, there's an almost insatiable demand within their country anyway for protein. So when you're saying that, and you've been boots on the ground in China, do you think there's a price point not too far from this 950-ish level that China basically backs off as far as some of the, whether that's soybeans, David, or whether it's other, you know, whether it's U.S. grains that are being exported to China? Do you think there's a price point at which, you know, whether it's corn or soybeans, that they step back and they say no mas?
Absolutely. But they also have a, they have a mandate, and you know, I trained some of the large soybean traders in the PRC whenever they were still handling it all in the government level, and then they went into the 50% ownership with a lot of these grain trading companies, and then since then they've put out an additional mandate, and that is that they're going to hold a certain amount of buffer stocks to protect themselves. And that, you know, the pandemic thing brought up that more to the forefront. You've got to make sure what happens in China. The biggest threat to what losing power is not having food. You know, they're not going to lose an election. And so unrest has got to be handled with a steady supply of food. So now they have these buffer stocks, and they go into a liquidation and a rebuilding. And, you know, like right now, they may have finished rebuilding their strategic supply of oil. And now you may see that back off a little bit. But another very important factor is what's the value of the currency? You know, they decide make or buy. They decide, should we make ethanol in the ground or should we buy it? Should we grow pork and beef or should we buy it? And so they have these numbers, but now they have a mandate and they're still rebuilding their hog herd. And so, you know, I saw the other day that some of the gasoline consumption, the only place in the world that's above year ago levels is in China. Car sales running above year ago levels. So they went through a huge contraction in their protein market and they're still trying to catch up. So that halt in buying, that NOMOS, it could be a little bit higher than what it would ordinarily be.
Now, you guys, you just mentioned some energy, but before I get to energy, I wanted to ask you about some of these things that you provide for customers that are looking for some sort of hedging they want to consult with you. They want you to be their advisor for some of these products, you know. So I imagine that you do a fair amount in derivatives as well, which is what we do. My brother and I are almost exclusively, yes, we trade stocks, just like you trade futures, David, but we trade an awful lot of derivatives. It's probably 9-1 derivatives against stock. When you're out there and somebody's seeking, whether it's a grain elevator or whether it's a group of farmers that have got together and they're saying, you know, how can I cut down on my margin calls or what kind of hedge can I have against either volatility or against price movement? You guys provide services like that, from what I've read.
Right.
What sort of advice would you be giving right now, given volatilities in the grains in particular, that side of the market? I'll get to energy and other things in a minute, but I was interested in, you know, corn, soybean, sure, wheat, that kind of stuff.
Well, after I get done with this taping, I have a weekly call with an ethanol producer, and I'm also very, I think that a hedger, when you convene a meeting, you need to check your opinion at the door. And instead, you need to utilize strategy. And I'm a huge advocate of using options. And, you know, they give you a definition of risk. They allow you to maybe leverage in the direction of your risk. And you also, wild things happen in the market. We are from boom and bust at any given time. So I like to use leveraged options in the direction of where their price risk is, and try and avoid trying to know what you think's a fair value. And I'm a big advocate of a longer term hedge for buyers of commodities. Instead of going in on a month in, month out basis, I like to set a macroeconomic trap and catch a whole cycle of production and consumption in a particular commodity market. You know, in the grain markets, you've got the critical growing times in July and August and frost periods and USDA numbers. And so, you know, I have a lot of long call options, multiple call options that I may protect that premium with short futures. So I'm actually trying to give them leverage in their direction, but I'm also trying to get the money to pay for some of that hedging. Because if you pay, and have a premium expire, you basically raise your costs anyway. So, I try to keep opinion out of the hedging. And the only reason I use it is to try and determine what kind of personality of the, do I need a leveraged hedge? Are gains going to be so small in soybeans that my best hedge is to be long futures and protect that with a put? And what I've learned in 36 years is that you have to have a strategy that you can survive the worst and the best case scenario. You have to have a strategy that you don't get smoked out in the middle of volatility. So if you're not comfortable with what hedge you have on, it's the wrong hedge. So That's my lie. And I don't like to put on hedges in July and August in the midst of volatility in the growing season. Again, I like that longer term positioning.
Gotcha. Now, what would you say the mix is for people that are seeking that kind of consultancy from you guys? Would you say that it's producers, which I'll say, you know, farmers are producers, right? So they're worried about, you know, getting the crop into the ground, getting the crop growing, like you say, that growing season, as well as the frost and all anything else that could affect it, a really wet time when they need to get the crop out of the ground and makes it much more difficult. Would you say that it's mainly producers, or is it the end users, the Cargills, the Kellogg's, the, you know, the bit, without naming who your right. clients are, is it a mix of almost 50-50 of those two, or is it really slanted heavy on the farmer side and a couple of those really big users of those products?
Well, I'd say it's very well diversified, almost in even numbers. You know, I've been a consultant to ADM for over 30 years, and so I do a lot of presentations to some of their large clients, a lot of annual meetings, annual outlook meetings. And, you know, I try to, and sometimes my hedge services amount to just looking over the shoulder of the guys in-house that are making hedging decisions. So the CEO can turn to me and say, is there anything that could blow up in what they're doing? Because, you know, you have a lot of traders that get stuck and won't give up on a loser and then have a major problem. So I'm kind of like a third-party independent monitor. And, you know, I'll offer up my specific strategy, and sometimes they'll take it directly in-house, and sometimes they'll modify it.
Now, one of the inputs and one of the things dependent a lot on prices of corn and things are cattle. Obviously, at Hightower, you guys, one of the things that you cover is cattle. And so what can you tell us? I mean, obviously during the pandemic, David, there was a lot of discussion about some of the essential workers, the people that were going into those meat facilities or poultry or whatever. And they were on the front line, so to speak. And a lot of folks were saying we could see a spike in prices here because we don't have nearly enough folks going into and working in those slaughterhouses and so forth and meat processors, mainly because they were getting paid more to stay home than they would be making if they were to go in there. What can you tell us about your outlook for cattle here?
Well, I mean, they have, you know, if there's one thing American businesses, it's innovative and flexible. And while, like Winston Churchill said, you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've run out of doing the wrong thing. And they learned, and now they're going to have distancing. They've implemented production barriers and so forth. So it was a short-term thing that really aggravated the demand setback. Because, I mean, if you can't get the beef, if you don't eat a steak today, you don't eat three tomorrow. And so that created a kind of a backlog. You didn't have the supply, but you also cut into demand. And you know what? Beef is a cyclical prosperity item. And so globally, it's getting more traction. I mean, some of the places I've been to Southeast Asia, 15 years ago, you didn't see any beef. And now you're seeing that quite a bit. So as the economy comes back, I wouldn't be surprised to see a significant surge in beef and cattle prices.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm looking here at that, some of those April lows, it was pushing down, at least I'm looking at feeder cattle here. I'm not sure which one that you'd be most, you obviously have to follow them all, but
right,
I'm
right.
looking at it pushing down to 113 and stuff like that back in April, and then hitting a high just in mid-August of maybe 150 plus. That's a pretty big swing, right?
Exactly. You know, and the beef market's a little slower to adapt. You know, it has a longer cycle of production. It's also a more expensive item, and it's not as culturally, you know, everything's Asia. You know, China's important, but Southeast Asia has 900 million people. And so and the average age there is very low. And so what those diets are transforming into, more pork first and then maybe beef in the end. So I actually find the pork market to be much more attractive because we China's going to have to go a long time building back what it had in its herd and having that strategic supply. And another major thing that happened with this pandemic is China was primarily a fresh meat consumer. And now we've changed the consumer styles over there to where they will eat frozen. So that kind of opens up the our export market to their demand.
Yeah, well, clearly there's been a when China has had several of these issues, it has impacted their ability to get enough of that protein in particular to their people, which you would think bodes well for our farmers and ranchers and things like that. Let's switch gears just a little bit maybe and talk about what's going on in energy. I mean, we've seen that nice rebound, but the demand is still not anywhere near where it was prior to February. And that's for a whole host of reasons. We know it's COVID related, but when you're not putting all those international flights, domestic flights, cruise lines that run on diesel almost exclusively, those, right. You know, they're running on fuel oil and more or less diesel sorts of situations. What about, first I want to ask you about oil, and then I want to ask you about gas, because I've got a reason for that.
All right. Well, you know, in the crude oil market, we, the rig operating count, I mean, the markets are doing their job. Do the markets overdo their job? Yes. Does it take a while for fundamentals to come back in line? Yes. But we saw the lowest rig operating count since 2005 in the second week of August. You know, there's this delayed reaction. It takes about 12 months after you begin to precipitously pull down the amount of production that you're getting by halting the rigs. Okay, it filters through the system. You bring in the rigs you drilled, and then all of a sudden you run out of that. So we're at that point already. And so after adding 1.8 to 2 million barrels of the shale and all these other miracles, we pulled out 1.8 million barrels. Okay, so the miracle that caused the oversupply in the world, we pulled it back. And it's not from a commitment from OPEC Plus that they voluntarily cut back production. It's real money. If you can't make money on it, you close it down. You will open some of that back up. But what we did is we went a long way toward keeping down the surplus backup that we had from the shutdown. And I think you, somebody on CNBC, and by the way, I've, you know, for 36 years, I've watched this, and, you know, CNBC does a heck of a job in the people they have on. And I heard someone say earlier this week that there's been 890 million miles driven lost because of the inability to go to work. And so, you know, we had a huge demand hit, but we've also lowered supply at the same time. And some of it's voluntarily and others of it is not. And so I'm upbeat that we made it through this crisis and did not just put a multi-year bear market into place. But you're right, the products are a different story.
Well, so let me hit that natural gas, because various types of natural gas, I think, are going to be in high demand, in particular for cities like New York. And in this case, David, I'm not thinking so much in terms of you know, instant power, you know, because obviously natural gas has been a clean and very quick way to get power plants to generate power when people need it. But I'm thinking more of along the lines of, in New York, they still have a very limited amount of restaurants that are letting anybody in. A lot of them are closed, of course, and may never come back. But the ones that are surviving are doing takeout heavy, and they're doing, they've been helped in the summer, at least, by being able to have people on the street, you know, as unattractive as it seems to me, somebody that works in New York a lot, I know I don't want to be eating on the street a lot, because there's just a whole host of bad things that are lurking out there on the street. I mean, it's not necessarily dangerous per se, David, but it's also not nearly the same experience when you're sitting, you know, out there on a street with, you know, the waiters and waitresses wearing masks and you're wearing masks and you're, you know, getting your food out there on the street. It's not that same experience as the white tablecloth in the restaurant and so forth. So when they try to survive this and the weather gets cooler, I think we're going to be seeing those, you know, stands, they'll be ubiquitous in New York. Whether it's bars or restaurants, they'll be trying to social distance, of course, as best they can, but they'll be basically having those heat lamps that are generated by LP gas. You know, that's right. That little tank of gas that we put on our barbecues and so forth. But you multiply that by all of the folks that are going to be experiencing that from Oregon, Washington, Minnesota, Ohio, New York, Pennsylvania, all the northern cities and states where they're going to try to still provide some sort of help for those restaurants and let people eat outside, I think that's going to put a demand again on natural gas. I mean, the June low was about $1.70 for the nat gas futures over at the CME, and it went a full dollar higher than that just in, you know, basically 2 months, right?
Right. And you know, what you're talking about, it really smooths out or eliminates the shoulder season. So you have heavy cooling demand, then you go into a pause in the fall because you're not running the air conditioner and it's not cold enough yet for the heat. And so if you have that transition in the fall to where people are trying to do that, that's going to create demand. The other major thing that's been happening in the background, and we had a pipeline that was destroyed temporarily in the Gulf. But over the last 10 years, we've begun to construct a lot of these export terminals. I think 8 years ago, we had none. Then we had several. And then 3 years ago, we had 35 that were seeking approval from the EPA.
And so, these are those LNG, that liquid.
LNG. And so we take the natural gas, process it into LNG, and then ship it out. And again, China has been showing that interest in that. The dollar's low, so we got a very low BTU cost in dollars for natural gas. But I think more importantly is, I mean, you're seeing these sovereign bonds and European banks that are saying we're not gonna do financing for dirty fuel. And while natural gas is not completely clean, it's a middle step. I mean, you just can't go to green fuel tomorrow, even though there are political factions that think you can do that overnight. But, you know, it's less polluting, and a lot of the world is going to go to that instead of, and, you know, if you just eradicate coal, the biggest problem for natural gas has been that coal is so cheap that no one could even afford to do it. And boy, you know, in Mongolia and Beijing, I've seen one time in Beijing, it was so bad that when I walked out of the hotel, I walked back in and I said, I will not be taking off today because of the fog. The person at the front desk said, it's not fog, it's pollution. And you could walk into someone as you're walking down the street. And so, you know, they'll have 300 million people with lung disease probably show up in the next couple of years. So they're forced. They got to really go fast when it comes to LNG.
One of my last questions.
So, John, this is a very cheap area for natural gas. I mean, this is a disclaimer. I have a lot of natural gas in my pension. So, it's a cheap energy source and it's halfway clean. How's that?
Yep. What about the, you mentioned, you know, that there was a pipeline that was impacted. Maybe one of the reasons was, Hurricane Laura. Marco hit first and then Laura.
Right.
If you could give the listeners like a little, quick update on how long things shut down when those hurricanes are coming, especially when you've got two of them back to back, just 2 days apart. Obviously, they had to get people off the rigs in that were in harm's way. And then how long does it take to get both those people back out there so you get the production back up, and then the production and transmission from those oil refineries and so forth? Knocking it out for what, 2-3 weeks, or is it a lot less than that?
Yeah, I think it's a lot less than that, particularly in this case, because the Laura did not really build speed until it was closer to shore. And so if you look at the location of these rigs and the platforms, it, when it came through some of the fields, it wasn't that strong. And, they've, again, like the meat processing people, they've learned and they've hardened these shelters. And in this case, it was an offshore pipeline that got damaged. But we are now building these significantly underground. I'm sure they're going to, but I think some of the facilities are going to be back up by September 11th. So, it's not as long as it used to be. I mean, you have to have a major infrastructure, and there's so many different platforms. Once the weather's cleared and the winds are down, they helicopter these people right back out there. And if there's no damage to repair, they turn it on pretty quick.
Well, I mean, I think we've covered just about everything. I've just got one topic left, and that's one that is near and dear to my brothers and my heart, and that is the precious metals.
Ah, good. I'm glad you brought that up.
Energy is great, and I love to talk about that. But, man, the metals, anybody that's had metal in their account, David, and anybody that's been following David on the Hightower Report, folks, knows what he thinks of it. But if you're new to it, I wanted you to hear it from David himself. What's your outlook here after this monster run for silver and gold?
Well, I don't want to come off as a tin hat guy, but I think that the first time since 1980, we have a honest to goodness classic physical commodity market rally brewing in gold and silver. Okay, I'm not denying the prospect that a November election brings the largest amount of uncertainty maybe since 1776. Threatening capitalism, lower dollar. If the Democrats don't sweep, you can expect gridlock to go for another 4 years. And so there's a lot of those safe haven things, lower currency, and the world's diversifying. And right now they're saying, the U.S. used to be the reserve currency. They were safe. We knew what was going on. But I got to tell you, the flight from the dollar is maybe that's because people don't see that as a certain or definable any longer. And when you have a Federal Reserve that comes out and says, look, we're going to hold rates down for longer than we need to. They said we want full employment and we want inclusion in employment. So we're raising the bar on the tolerance of the Fed for inflation. So we're setting up the first classic economic textbook type of inflationary potential. But to me, that's not the issue. The issue is the classic supply and demand. We've had the first decline in production last year after 12 years of expansion. Okay. So it's not necessarily a production issue, but what comes down is this ETF inflow. I mean, if you extrapolate the first 6 months of the year inflows to gold, and it's like unlikely that it'll continue at that pace all the way into the end of the year. But if it did, that would be the net equivalent addition to demand of 1,300 tons. Okay, let's put that in perspective. China is 900 tons of demand annually. India is 800 tons of demand annually. Have those demand levels fall off? Absolutely. India completely shut off for several months of imports. And now we've had the first resumption of imports into India. So if you say, okay, maybe they peeled off 400 tons each. So maybe the world demand equation lost, 800 tons of gold. but we still might have 1,000 or 1,300 in fresh demand that we've never had before. So if you find out that, look, we're going to have a tight situation, and you do see any wild uncertainty out of the election, and I also believe that the nagging, unending infection headwind, I mean, we've got the longest headwind of anyone in the world right now. So undoubtedly, our rates are going to remain lower longer than everywhere else. So the Fed's opened itself up. So I see a two-pronged thing. You've been around long enough that once a market gets hot and once it starts to get falling in the press, the investment's going to flow. And when the small guy is really throwing his money into it, then maybe we're getting to the end of the rainbow. But, boy, I really don't even like to give projections on gold because people think you're nuts. But Warren Buffett, you know, he got into the gold mining sector. A lot of fund managers are doing the same, and India and China people are going to be back. I mean, we saw the biggest import in 4 months in India. So I don't know. It's a very interesting market, which I think on pullbacks in the market, you need to be a buyer. $1,900 is value. $27 is value in silver. And, you know, a lot of people say maybe silver's the better horse for the second half of the race. You know, I mean, it's just barely above half of what the record high is. So, I'm a classic fundamental commodity guy, but I could see both pistons fired on the gold rally.
Cool. Well, David, I can't thank you enough, sir. Folks, we've been having a conversation on compound interests with David Hightower, the guy whose name is on the door, and it's HightowerReport.com is how you can go on the internet, research what his subscriptions are, get a free trial. I'd encourage you to check out the work that David and his team do. David, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Good luck. Stay safe.
All right, you too, man.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.